You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vickers Media Motel.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Periscope Ups and Downs. Who is David Cameron? How to solve homelessness in the UK? Goodbye to Letterman. And job seeking on Channel 4.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. This is the Parish Council. It's your podcast from the Media Motel. As ever, I'm Magnus Shaw, and he's so fine. He's Terence Dackham.
He's so fine. Hello, Magnus Shaw. Now, remind me why. Mm-hmm. Great inconvenience to both me and the listener. We're recording this on a Sunday morning, the traditional day of rest, I may remind you.
Oh, because yesterday, actually Friday, when we normally record, I was airborne. I was over Europe, flying back in from the glorious island of Crete.
Oh. Yeah. And did you and Mrs. de Magnus Shaw have a delicious time in yet another one of your holidays away?
Yeah, of course, yes. We stayed in Agios Nikolaos, which is just idyllic. You wouldn't want to return, believe me. Beautiful.
Goodness. Nigel Farage contacted me during the week and he said, why doesn't this Magnus Shaw holiday in the UK? What's wrong with the UK? Does he hate the UK? That's what Nigel Farage
Well, you can tell Mr. Farage that in about a month I'm going to stay in a little cottage in Cornwall for a week. So he can put that in his rather blue-coloured pipe and smoke it.
And smoke it, indeed. Mm. Oh, well, and that's about a month away, so that's quite a long time between breaks.
Yeah, a very long time. Yeah, well, we're into my holiday season now, you see.
I see. Yeah. No doubt we'll be hearing about you going to America in about a month after that.
November. No, October, I beg your pardon.
Slow me down. Yeah. Well, I never. Now, while you were away, I went a bit nuts.
You never.
Yeah. I had a day of complete loopiness, hunting down people on Periscope. I know. This was a day last week. I'll just very quickly recap what Periscope is for anyone who still doesn't know. It's an app owned by Twitter that enables, at the moment, iPhone users to broadcast live footage of anything they want through the camera on their iPhones. Some people have used this very creatively. I've seen live gigs, sports, games, people who are live casting, sharing their daily lives with viewers. And there's currently a fascinating feed by a woman called Colleen Byack, who is broadcasting segments of her visit to North Korea. And that has been really
interesting. That would be very interesting,
It has been.
She doesn't want to get caught doing that, though, does she?
Well, she's got permission, apparently.
Really?
She's on a kind of official visit. Yeah. Many people are criticising her because her broadcasts are rather pro-North Korean, it must be said. So, but nonetheless, it's interesting because you just get to see at least tiny little glimpses of life in the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. But, you see, Magnus Shaw, there are an increasing number of Egypts, and I'm really sorry to say this, but nearly all in America, I do feel obliged to say, I'm terribly sorry, but who are periscoping from their cars. And I noticed this last week, periscoping from their cars as they're driving.
Oh, dear.
And they're either holding the phone in one hand or at best resting it in a holder. But here's the thing, they're reading comments on the Chinese screen and replying while they're driving, just about the craziest thing you could do while you're driving that you can imagine.
That doesn't sound good. Certainly in some states in America, it is now illegal to use your mobile while you drive. But they were late to that, though. They were quite late, the Americans, to that. I suppose, the Americans don't like any sort of legislation about your personal behaviour, do they? They're very touchy.
Well, exactly, that's the thing. It was rather out of character for me. I noticed people doing this, so I started looking for people doing this, and I jumped onto their Periscope feed and tried to persuade them of the badness of what they were doing. I know none of my business. I think in the UK, just like you said, we've become used to a way of life that has accepted that it's lunacy to, text while you're driving. But in the USA, the land of the free, there's more of a feeling of, you know, butt out, buddy, I'll do what I like.
Oh, very much. But as a motorcyclist, you know, I see somebody, you know, overtaking me and they're on their phone. And, you know, I couldn't be more against it because on two wheels, you're really vulnerable out there and you really rely on people on four wheels to have, you know, at least some sense and some decorum about their behaviour on the road. And if they're on the phone, it gets me really mad because...
Well, that's exactly it, because reading streams of comments, whether it's on Periscope or texting while you're driving a car on any road, I mean, it strikes me as idiotic and highly dangerous. But just as you said, it's to other road users. Yes. I mean, you know, okay, if you're stupid enough, that's up to you. But, you know, if this becomes accepted practice, we may as well project live television onto our windscreens as we're going along.
Well, as the truck drivers have been arrested watching movies on their laptop as they drive along. And you only have to think of Cozy Powell. You remember, Cozy Powell met his end using a very early mobile phone whilst driving his convertible sports car, didn't he? That's how
I had either forgotten or didn't
know that. That's right. Yes. His last words were "Oh shit!" as he spoke into his phone.
He spoke from the heart. Yes, one would say something similar.
Yeah,
to that,
And
mostly, I was reasonably politely. Because, you know, most American people are quite polite. I was told to kind of chill out. It isn't dangerous. They know what they're doing. But I did notice that after I got on to these Periscope feeds and pointed this out, lots of people dropped off from following the feed, and many of the Periscopers ended the broadcast abruptly. So maybe I did make some people think that.
So. Yeah, the phrase, they know what they're doing, is always followed by abject disaster, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that, you know, that's what struck me. I mean, my mini campaign, for what it's worth, is for Twitter and Periscope, at the very, very least, to have a pop-up when anyone downloads the app stating that it must not be used by anyone in control of a vehicle.
Yeah, that seems entirely sensible, I think. Yeah. Although completely ignorable as well.
Oh, of course. But if, you know, even just makes people think, because we are, I'm sure, only days, if weeks, if we're lucky, away from, you know, someone just like Cozy Powell, it'd be someone broadcasting live their demise as they're periscoping, reading a snarky comment from someone, and you know, driving into a lamppost.
And then the footage will probably go viral, won't they?
I'm afraid. Here's a question for you, Magnus Shaw. Here's a question for you. Who is David Cameron?
you might well ask. Yes,
there was a widely reported story this week while you were sunning yourself in the Greek islands.
Yes.
After a Facebook message went viral, 21-year-old Devon Boone, a lady from Stoke-on-Trent, noted she noticed that this name was cropping up on her Facebook feed, and she actually asked, and I quote, "Who's David Cameron, and why do people keep posting about him?" And one of her friends replied, "He's one of them politic MP people," which was helpful. Devon Boone said in reply, and I'm quoting directly, "Oh, I don't even know. I don't vote or know how. Ha, ha, ha. I don't follow politics. Lol. Don't see the point in Tony Blair and whoever else, Bin Laden." End of quote. Clearly, it became, you know, later it became clear that she had confused Osama bin Laden with Barack Obama. Now, many people would laugh and sneer at Devon Boone. Are you laughing, or do you despair at the educational standards in a country where Devon Boone studied A-level art but doesn't know who David Cameron is?
Well, I suppose you're entitled to be ignorant of anything you so choose. But it just seems a bit of a shame, because it just speaks of a wider unawareness of your surroundings and your environments and the things that impact your life. Whether you follow politics or not, or know who David Cameron is or not, or think the President of the United States is Osama bin Laden, it doesn't change the fact that all those things are actually impacting your life. And it seems a shame to be so unaware of the things that make a difference to your everyday existence. So I don't deride Devon Boone particularly, and she's entitled to, you know, live her life and assume whatever knowledge she so chooses. But it does seem to be a missed opportunity to take part in the wider world of which you're a part. Does it reflect? So, yeah, it does reflect on education, I think. But presumably, if this had been widely covered at school, she wouldn't be quite so out of the loop.
Well, this is it. This is where I want to take this a bit, because she, by the way, she posted about how Tony Blair and Osama bin Laden are, quote, the only prime ministers I know. And no is spelled N-O throughout all of this.
Of course it is. Yes, of course it is.
Now, here's the thing. She was a customer advisor at an insurance company before she recently went on maternity leave. And as I say, she studied A-levels. I think she does make an excellent point. She was interviewed. She said, they should teach you about the government and politics and mortgages at school. And I mean, yes, they should. I'm horrified that they don't. But, Devon Boone, in an interview with a newspaper, she went on to explain how little she knows about the world around her. And this made me think yet again about how we have allowed schools and teachers to run their own agenda, as you know, I was and am a huge supporter of Michael Gove's reforms in education. And I'm, you know, we've got to wait and see if Nicky Morgan carries them forward. But I believe this whole question of education and responsibility for our own actions, including social awareness and so on, this was brought home to you whilst on your now infamous Greek island last week.
Well, yeah, tangentially, yes. Yes, I was talking to a barman at the hotel I was staying at, and my wife actually asked him, which nationalities do you like to serve? The hotel was fairly cosmopolitan. There were Poles, there were Russians, there were Germans, and there were Brits, no Americans. And so my wife asked, who do you enjoy serving the most? And he said, well, I enjoy serving the English. And I said, well, you don't have to say that just because we're English. We're generally curious. And he said, no, 50% of the English people I serve are the most charming customers I have. But 50% are the rudest, most ignorant and nastiest people I have to deal with. So half of the English people are my favourite people. And we said, feels quite embarrassed about the other half. And his English was very good. And he says, what's interesting is that the Poles are reliably jovial, big drinkers, very happy, good sense of humour. The Russians are a bit more austere and, they're a bit more poker-faced and chilly. They said, but only the English split into two. Everybody else is reliably, culturally predictable. But the English split completely in two. So it just made me wonder what half of us are getting wrong to engender such a terrible reputation with Greek barmen.
Well, I think it links in with a combination of parents, teachers and administrators carrying a heavy responsibility for the lack of knowledge and education of our young people. Parents, probably the greater responsibility. But in terms of education, they're these kind of Devon Boone characters and presumably the appalling people behaving terribly in Greece, are taking A-levels and going to university. But these people that we're talking about, they take A-levels, but they don't know the capital of France, and they can't add, say, 17 to 24.
I'm not sure I could do 17.
Oh, dear, don't say that. Yes, you could.
Yeah.
I don't know if this has got anything to do with it, but in the UK, as a country, we say you only need to go to school for 39 weeks in a year, 195 days. I mean, that to me is absolutely crazy. Why do children and teachers need 13 weeks holiday every year? And I bet there are countless people listening in contracted employment that maybe get 20, 25 days annual leave. Teachers get 65 days. It's absolutely insane. And schools in the UK only run half days, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and you get lunch and tea breaks. That's not a full day. That's about 25 hours a week. In fact, the Department of Education, I checked this yesterday, states that junior schools must run 23 and a half hours teaching time a week. 23 and a half hours, that's madness. And I'm suggesting that contributes to Devon Boone thinking Osama bin Laden is running the free world, and your barman saying, oh, you know, we get half of, you know, the British people over here behaving appallingly.
I don't know that time spent in the classroom is necessarily directly linked to this, but for as long as I can remember, and we certainly said this as kids, and we were probably onto something, is that most of what is taught in the classroom is so purely academic that it has no application in the outside world. Typically this is said about algebra, isn't it? Is that the minute you leave school, algebra means absolutely nothing at all.
You never use it again.
I suppose unless you become a statistician or you go on to teach maths, and they're perhaps the only times that it becomes relevant. So I think what you say about time is, of course, always countered by the fact that teachers have to do a lot of work which isn't based in the classroom.
Come on.
Well, I'm the parents of two teachers, and I know some teachers, and I do see that they work incredibly hard outside of the classroom if they're doing their job properly. But I don't think it's time spent.
If they do the job properly, and that's possibly my point, is that the ones I'm talking about are ones who knock off at 3 p.m. and go home and watch Escape to the Country.
Well, I don't know any of them. But I'm not sure it's time spent in the classroom. It's relevancy of what we're taught. And I remember when I was at school that if you went on to sixth form, and I did my sixth form at college, so it was different, but if you went on to sixth form, it's only then that did a subject appear called current affairs.
Well, this is absolutely ridiculous, isn't it?
Prior to the sixth form, there was no subject current affairs. And I think when my kids went to school, it was only in later school that they had a subject called, was it social responsibility, social citizenship, something like that, which spoke about tax returns, renting a property, applying for a mortgage, opening a bank account, taking a driving test, whatever, you know, the nuts and bolts of being a functioning adult human being. And that was only sort of injected at a later stage. And I genuinely think that these should be subjects that are there from the word dot. As soon as you stop doing finger painting and have proper lessons, one of those lessons should be current affairs and another one should be citizenship. Why on earth would you not have that? Because they are the things you need to know when you move on into adult life. And also, it covered in certainly the social citizenship, is how to behave to other human beings, how to respond to somebody who's serving you, how to ask somebody a question, how to be conciliatory in a conflict situation. Those kind of things are what we really value as we get older. I'm notorious in my family for having a head full of trivial facts, which is very useful when playing board games, but otherwise it's just a party trick. What really matters is how to be decent. I mean, I would be all in favour of a subject at school called decency. That would be good. Rather than, I'm not saying don't teach geometry, but hours and hours of geometry at the expense of current affairs and citizenship, I think the balance is wrong. I think schools have always been too academically focused and not life skills focused.
A working knowledge, say a week a year, unless you're going to specialise, a week a year would be enough, spread over a year, of algebra, physics and chemistry, mm-hmm. I would say would be enough, instead of forcing those subjects down the throat of children who are completely uninterested and really perhaps even ill-prepared to be able to accommodate that sort of information. So in that case, we'd have plenty of time then for helping and leading young people into exactly the sort of things that you were describing, which include, you know, responsibility for our own actions and the social awareness that I was talking about. But now I accept that it's not all about the time spent in school. I fully do accept that. However, my final point on this really is just to contrast and compare. Our Department of Education says that schools must run a minimum of 23 and a half hours teaching time each week. China, Schools run from 7:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. They have a 6-week break in the summer only, but that time is spent in what, summer classes. Mm-hmm. So they're not actually, you know, at home. Now, that might be an extreme. Let's look at France, though. 36 hours a week. Remember, again, we do 23 and a half. South Korea, a really lively, burgeoning economy. South Korea, 48 weeks compared to our 39, and they do 40 hours a week, the children, mm-hmm. instead of 23 and a half. Yeah. In the UK, we have Devon Boone, and that's you know, really, you know, where my point finishes on that.
Yes, well, I mean, speaking about my seemingly endless travels, and I have been I have been in places, particularly I remember an instance when I was in the Canaries and speaking to somebody there, and they didn't know where they were. I mean, they knew they were on Gran Canaria, and they knew an aeroplane had taken them from East Midlands Airport to Gran Canaria and deposited them there. When I said we're off the coast of Africa, they thought I was joking.
I know it's extraordinary, but it doesn't surprise me. There's a, you know, yet another example of, you know, not, I said earlier, people in this country, they've heard of France, but they wouldn't be able to tell you what the capital is. And they certainly, if you said to them, here's a map of the world, broadly point out where the Canary Islands might be, wouldn't have a clue.
No, that's right. They genuinely thought I was having them on when I said we could get a boat to Africa. They thought they were in Spain because, of course, the Canary Islands are owned by the Spanish, but are a long way from mainland Spain. They thought they were in Spain. And, I mean, technically, geopolitically, they were in Spain, but they thought they were near the Spanish mainland. And what's more, had we not had this conversation, they would have flown all the way to the Canary Islands and back again and never had any idea exactly where they'd been. How bizarre is that?
I find it astonishing, and I know there's nothing worse than older people saying, well, when I was a lad, I pored over atlases and globes. I had an insatiable appetite for looking at maps and understanding where places were. Nothing to do with school. It just absolutely intoxicated me. You know, I'm trying to understand how, you know, I was just a tiny dot on, you know, this tiny island in a great big globe. I don't know what's happened. No, well, nobody's interested.
I think for me, general knowledge is like that. I just found that the more things I knew, the better I felt. That's really all I can say, is that the acquiring knowledge just seemed to me to be tremendously exciting. The fact that I had a capacity, unlike a dog or a cat, I had the capacity to acquire and store knowledge, just seemed to be magic to me, and I sort of never ceased to go about that. I don't know everything about everything, of course I don't, and some things I don't know anything about, usually sports based, but I feel more powerful the more knowledge I acquire, and I don't know where that came from. Presumably my parents, but that's something that I just feel very sad if there are people who don't have that sense of empowerment that can be gained from knowledge. All that said, my daughter and my daughter's boyfriend do have a thirst for knowledge. They ask me stuff, they ask other people stuff, they go and find stuff out, and they tell me things that I don't know. So, you know, it's not universal. Indeed, my daughter's boyfriend can take a map of America with the state borders marked on it, but no writing, and he can fill in all the states.
I don't think I could do that.
No, I could do that at all, and I've watched him do it, but he is a geographer by profession and by trade. So, but yeah, he has that passion. He loves aeroplanes, he loves travelling, he loves geography. So it is still out there, and people are still appreciating it, but that needs to be introduced to people. So look, it's not something you can buy, and it's not something you need to buy. You can just have this, you can just have knowledge, and when you've got it, wow. You know, so many windows and doors become open to you, and you feel so powerful for having had it. I think that's lacking, and I think that needs injecting into the syllabus, definitely.
One of the other big social questions in the UK is a resolution to the housing crisis. A huge number of local authority homes were sold off at a massive discount under Mrs. Thatcher's right to buy scheme, meaning that there are fewer and fewer homes to rent from the public sector. And meanwhile, supply and demand has led to a market where buying a first home is way out of reach for many people, even those on a good salary. Well, what can be done? The wonderfully named City of Medicine Hat in Alberta, Canada, has come up with an interesting solution that has just about ended homelessness in that city. They simply give housing to anyone that needs it. Now, Canada has a lot more free space, of course, than the UK, but why not cut out all the admin and politics and just give homes to people?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I really like this kind of visionary civil politics. So often the bigger picture cannot be seen. So the same is true of drug abuses that or drug use, perhaps we should say, is that the bigger picture is never seen, that we are constantly just spending a fortune trying to enforce laws and to mop up casualties when a more cohesive picture could be drawn and money could be saved. If it's just about money, and so much is just about money, then money could be saved, as the good people of Medicine Hat. And of course, we have to bow to a town that calls itself Medicine Hat. What a fabulous name. That they have seen the bigger picture, that is actually more expensive to maintain homelessness than to actually just give people homes. And it always excites me when this kind of policy swings into action and you see the results. The comparable incidents, I think, was in New York under Mayor Giuliani, when he had a philosophy, you have to call it a philosophy really, because it goes beyond a policy, which he called broken windows. And by that he meant that if you tolerate a certain level of low level of vandalism and social irresponsibility, then that ripples up to violent crime, gangsterism, and social deprivation. And so he said, in areas of New York City where a few broken windows are just shrugged off and nobody bothers to mend them, nobody bothers to, you know, the police don't bother to investigate who broke them, and they're just tolerated, then that produces an enormous effect further down the line, a ripple effect further down the line. And so he set about ensuring that in impoverished areas, buildings weren't left to rack and ruin with broken windows. And New York is, it depends how you measure it, but substantially safer than it was in the 70s and 80s, where there were no-go areas. And this all stemmed from this notion of broken windows. So I love this sort of big thinking social policy that actually seems to have an effect and goes against, you know, it's counterintuitive in many ways, but actually, when you think about it, there's a beautiful logic to it.
When I read this story about Medicine Hat, it rang a bell, because I remembered reading a story last year, and so I looked this back up. A strikingly similar deal that happens in Utah in the USA. 10 years ago, Utah realized it had 2,000 people who were, the phrase they use, chronically homeless, i.e. not just, you know, briefly, you know, down on the luck and everything would be all right. And also that they were using up a huge amount of social services. So Utah just decided to give those 2,000 people, give them all homes. And in 10 years, there's been a 74% drop in homelessness. In terms of cost, and as you remark, this is, of course, important. Salt Lake City calculates it costs $20,000 a year to look after homeless people, but only $8,000 a year to give them housing.
Absolutely.
So Canada and America are seeing the benefit. You know, you don't ticket or jail homeless people, give them a home.
Yeah.
And my great idea for the UK, I'm a bit obsessed by this, I have to say, construct small homes. We're a smaller country, of course, and we can't obviously build, you know, an endless stream of mansions for people. So the size of a decent you know, what they call mobile homes or park homes, maybe 300 or 400 square feet. And again, maybe not as a long-term life home, but to get people shelter and off streets. So a small home, 300 or 400 square feet. And now where are we going to put them? And this is where my obsession comes in. Look at the amount of wasted space by motorways and railways. And next time anybody, you take a rail journey in particular, notice the huge amount of scrubland near railway stations. And this, I've looked into this, and this is from the original days when railway companies, 100 plus years ago, just bought or were given huge tracts of public space because they did, oh, you need to build a railway station. Well, we've got lots of room. Here, have this. And if you look now, much of that space is just scrubland. Now, imagine my 300 square feet homes in those wasted bits of land all across the country and near motorways as well, right next to, in this, you know, my example, next to railway stations so people can get to work, sell them the homes. Now, people are going to say, oh, but what if they don't pay? Let them stay there, but they don't get ownership, so they're still sheltered. And if you look around, as I say, you take these journeys, and, you know, in another one, which initially you say, oh, come on, but think about it. If you look under the subway at the south side of Waterloo Bridge, there's a huge underground area there where people sleep rough every night. They call it Cardboard City. If we actually put homes down there and just gave them to people, you've given all those people a start in life. Why don't we do all these things?
Yeah, no, it's because somehow somebody somewhere will say, well, I wasn't given my home, so why should somebody else get given theirs? And you get this sort of bitterness about the whole thing. But I think you have to ignore those voices and say, tough, we've got a social issue here, and here's a proven way of addressing it. But I think politicians fear the voice of the embittered and envious in the system. And listen,
I wonder whether we could win the argument with those people by the costing element and saying, well, look, if we have these people in some cases in prison, the streets with social services, it's going to cost you this much. But if we just give them this home, this small home, as I say, not talk about luxury, but decent, good, you know, with all main services provided, this is the huge reduction in cost. We can actually bring your taxes down.
Well, yeah, that might ring some bells. Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I really like this sort of radical thinking, not in a sort of paper form of a sort of radical politics, but radical civil thinking is always exciting and often pays dividends. I see no reason to disagree with this. Unfortunately, London is being pushed the other way, where there are vast numbers of empty properties which are just solely there for investment, to be sold from one person to another without anybody ever occupying them. So the drift is in the wrong direction there, I believe.
That's right. But you see, my solution, my solution doesn't even interfere with that. If Russian oligarchs or, buy-to-let landlords want to do that sort of thing, well, it's a free market, carry on. But I'm talking about, in fact, the market would almost die for those people, other than, you know, they're sort of selling homes to Russian oligarchs, because I'm talking about setting up these smaller homes. They're additional homes. They're in scrubland, but in very prime real estate.
Yeah.
As I say, it's just my challenge to everybody. I won't over-milk this, but if you take a rail journey, as you pull out of a railway station, have a look at the huge amount of wasted space, and then think, how many homes of, say, 30 foot by 10 foot could I fit in there reasonably? And then think about how you'd then be putting those people right next to a railway station where they could go to employment.
Yeah, I think 30 foot by 10 foot might be a little bit kennel-like. I think you might have to go a little bit bigger than that.
Maybe. But,
the general principle I agree with.
Yeah.
And, of course, the construction and implementation of these places would create work in themselves, wouldn't they? So those projects would be wealth-generating, wouldn't they? So,
absolutely. Yeah. And whilst taking your point that it's not at the luxury end of the market, there is a big drive in America for tiny homes, where it's amazing how creative with this kind of space we need these days. You know, remember, we don't actually need, we'd like to have, but we don't need massive music collections. It could all be on an iPhone. You don't need masses of bookshelves because it could all be on a Kindle or similar device. So it's possible in a 30 foot or 40 foot by 10 foot space to have quite a decent, you know, it's a bedroom, bathroom, shower room, kitchen and living space. But, you know, we do tend to fill our homes with stuff we don't
need. I've always admired, I think in Tokyo and perhaps across the whole of Japan, you can't really call them hotels, but these temporary accommodation pods. If you find yourself at a restaurant having a jolly good time and you look at your watch and your last train is gone, you can't get home. You can wander down to the station and you can put, I don't know what, however many yen into an automated system, and a pod opens up and you can climb into it, and it's clean and disinfected, and there's fresh linen in there, and there's a little television in there, and knowing the Japanese, probably a disposable toothbrush and all the rest of it, and you can lie down, you can sleep, you can wake up, use the little sink, watch the morning news, climb out, and then get your first train in the morning. I just think that's fantastic. Why wouldn't we have everywhere? What a terrific idea.
Yeah, so. I couldn't agree with you more, and you know, again, it's the sort of way that we tend to lag behind the rest of the world in that sort of creative thinking.
Yeah, it's just imagination, isn't it?
I'm all for it.
We would come up with 150 reasons why we couldn't do it rather than just going ahead and doing it. I agree. And I like that. I like that as that painting outside the edges, I think, is the current management speak description. But I like that. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Oh, and the fair play to Medicine Hat. You've got a terrific name for your town and a very, very good bit of radical thinking there.
Exactly so. Now, Wednesday night was something of an occasion in the United States, the very last night of The Late Show with David Letterman. After well over 30 years and over 6,000 shows, the last show was aired on CBS on Wednesday. Later this year, Stephen Colbert will take over. Wednesday's show followed the regular format as much as possible, with clips instead of guests on the chairs, and Foo Fighters played the show out with Everlong. What did David Letterman bring to late night television over these 35 years?
Just a tremendous sense of humour. What I really like about Letterman, and I thought this last show was superb, by the way, I didn't want it to end. What I really like about David Letterman is that he delivers his quite surreal and absurdist sense of humour in a package which looks incredibly studious and conservative. He looks rather like the principal of a very expensive American college, with his penny loafers and white silk socks, and his, what appears, particularly on this show, his final show, the most expensive suit you could possibly buy in New York City. And yet behind all that, there is an anarchic streak and a genuine joy in humour. It's a real celebration of humour. But all delivered in this very sort of casual, louche manner. And I think that's what really appeals about Letterman. And I should say that I've been in the audience for the Letterman show. Yeah. And it is great. It's on like all your favorite TV shows, when you go there, you can't believe how small the operation is. It's a very compact, a tiny little theater, and the stage is much smaller than you imagine it to be, and all the rest of it. But Letterman is as big as you would want him to be. The audience love him, and they've every reason to. I think he's an incredibly charming and amusing man, and what a great career. 3,000 shows, I think, the Letterman has done.
in 6,000
6,000, thank you. All in that same format, although when we saw the clips running back, we realised it has subtly changed over the years. but essentially in that same format, himself and Paul Schaefer batting stuff backwards and forwards. But when you have a winning formula, you know, it's always unwise to tinker with it. And so he's certainly not tinkered with his own delivery. Former weatherman, of course, so it just
shows how your career can escalate.
I will miss him. The big mistake, and I think we've said this before, we've made in this country, is not taking the syndication of the Letterman show in a permanent slot every night on, well, just pick a channel. It doesn't matter where it went, but it should have sat there every night alongside the American broadcast, because it would have been a phenomenon over here. It was so good. We've tried to imitate the Letterman show with various British presenters in the past. Johnny Vaughan, Danny Baker spring to mind, trying to do exactly the same thing. It just shows how hard it is to do well, and Letterman makes it look ridiculously easy. It isn't. And he deserves all the plaudits he's ever had and will continue to get, even though he's now retired. Terrific.
It's certainly inspired a host of British copyists, as you say. One of the things I think he brought to American TV audiences is a sense of irony. We often say, oh, Americans don't get irony. But I think, you know, much of his style is that sort of tongue-in-cheek, isn't it?
Yeah, totally.
Some people may feel, and this may be a controversial point of view, but some people may feel that he should have retired maybe 5, even 10 years ago, particularly when there were some awkward scandals involving his private life. Uh-huh. But I think almost certainly it'll be a case of, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Absolutely. I mean, Stephen Colbert is very, very good, and I can't wait to see those new shows, because he's got a proven track record. But, you know, he won't try to be Letterman, and he's not Letterman. And I think Letterman's presence will be missed. I actually stayed at a different time in New York, stayed in the hotel right next to the Letterman Theatre. I mean, the two buildings were joined, and I had removed several bricks in the wall of my room, I think I could crawl through into the theatre there. So it was right next to it. So I feel I've been close to that show on a couple of occasions, and I'm glad I was. And unfortunately, when I was in the audience, people always say, oh, you went to the Letterman show. Who was the guest on the sofa? Well, you know, when I went to the Letterman show, the guest on the sofa was a guy whose name I can't remember, who was a very, very famous baseball player.
which wasn't
ideal for an Englishman visiting. Had I gone the night before, I'd have got Julia Roberts, but I got some guy who all the Americans seem to be delighted to see, but he was a baseball player. But you don't get to choose these things. You go to the little office on Times Square there, and you say, I want to go to Letterman. They take your name. They say, come back in 3 or 4 hours. We went back and they said, good news, you've got tickets for tonight. And that's it. You go along. Yeah.
And so, we'll never know if it was Mickey Mantle or Joe DiMaggio who was sitting
on the
stage. It
certainly wasn't Joe DiMaggio.
No, probably not. Some good gags on the final show that in retirement he hopes to become, I love this, the new face of Scientology.
That was a great gag, yes.
And with a veiled reference to his scandal, that he said if he screws up in life, he'll now have to go on other people's shows to apologise.
That was the only reference to his scandal.
Without wanting to end on the downer, I think it's probably a sad thing that in all of the clips and all of the thank yous to people that he's worked with, some significant people who he ended up in a bit of trouble with were kind of wiped from history there, including his personal assistant who became involved in some scandal there. But anyway, so we say all the best to Stephen Colbert, but I agree with you. I do think we'll miss Dave.
Whenever I've been to the States, and no visit to the States will ever be the same again, I have always spent, because you know how many channels you get in the States and on how many different platforms, I've always spent at least 20 minutes in my hotel room on the telly working out which channel is going to give me the Letterman show at 11:30, because it's always been part of my trip to the States, so it won't be quite the same again.
No, and as you say, one of the most extraordinary omissions that it wasn't fed daily over here.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Channel 4 carried it for a little while back in the 80s and 90s, and then it all fell away. I mean, and what a stupid mistake that was. Whatever it cost, they should have had it here.
And, of course, that time he came over here for a week and did an entire week's worth of shows from the UK to tie in with this. But it just petered out.
Yeah, it did.
One of the key debating points of the general election earlier this month was the always present consideration about reducing unemployment. Mr. Miliband tried to persuade us of the negative aspect of zero-hours contracts, whilst Mr. Cameron put his focus on sustained employment being at the centre of a settled life. Perhaps everyone would agree that looking for secure employment can be a very stressful time for the job seeker. Joining Job Centre Plus in the marketplace to match up job seekers with employers are a substantial number of private companies who have to keep an eye on profit as well as employment targets. On Wednesday of this week, Channel 4 aired the first of three programmes following a recruitment agency in Bradford. Would you like to be seeking a job through Candeliza People in Bradford?
I see no reason why not. They seem to work very hard at what they do. In terms of a television show, I'm just fed up with these things. I can't really get on board with another fly on the wall at a small business full of characters format. Just how lazy is it? This is no better or no worse than any of these other series that we've had. But can we stop them now, please? We've seen it all. I honestly really, really do not care whether young Phil, the new starter, meets his 10K target for the next month. It's very important to him, and it's very important to the job agency. It does not make a television series. We've got people being trained to be bus drivers. That apparently is adequate content for a TV series. We've got a job agency in Bradford. That's adequate content for a TV series. And we've had all the others. You know, we had small hotels. We've had the guys cleaning sewers. It's like this. I don't know what you call it. Occupation porn. I don't know what you call it, but we've seen enough of it. Stop commissioning them. They really are of no consequence, and I'm really, really bored with them.
Instead of analysing the issues of the current job market, we, of course, had to go on a journey with the rather hapless Phil, who you mentioned, a recruitment advisor who couldn't recruit. And, you know, rather tying in with what we were talking earlier, Phil himself seemed to lack skills for employment. And notably, I don't want to pick on the poor fellow, but I thought this intrigues me. So I looked him up and found out who he is and what he does. And he no longer works for Candeliza People. He's now cabin crew with EasyJet.
Oh, well, I just flew EasyJet 2 days ago back from Crete.
You may well have had Phil.
I didn't see Phil, no.
Oh, right. No, it's the usual thing. We had, you know, this was the story of Jane Vincent, who started this employment agency from, as they say, scratch. Candeliza People, very odd name for an employment agency, and the frontage of the agency looked like a sort of ladies' underwear shop from the outside. It was a peculiar thing. Opening 5 minutes, we sat in a staff meeting. It just reminded me of having been in these kind of things, and it just looked like hell on earth. You know, sitting in these meetings and everybody going around the table and reporting. Oh, God, you know, thank God I'll never, ever do that in my life again. Phil was recruited for call centres, which, again, looked like the worst job in the world. One of the things that struck me is, because the programme itself was just, you know, tiresome, it's debatable whether you should create a private business and profit margins out of unemployment would be one question it posed me. But what I found was telling, and this really ties up with your Greek experience and Devon Boone story earlier. What really struck me in this, and this was Bradford, it could have been anywhere, it was very telling the lack of preparation people had for the job market and social interaction. many, if not most, had no idea how to dress, speak, or handle themselves. Grooming was an unknown quantity. And I particularly will pick on a young lad called Danny, who was a weed smoker, but he was given a chance. He was given a lift on his first day to a job by one of the staff from the job recruitment centre. And then he failed to attend and got sacked. And all I want to say to you, Magnus Short, is this is the other side of the Job Centre Plus sanction process. Because, you know, we hear an awful lot in the press about, and admittedly, awful stories of people receiving sanctions on their benefits. But this is the reality of why some of those people actually need that sanctions process, because Danny himself said, I couldn't be bothered getting up in the morning. And, you know, are you smoking weed? No, I'm not. Are you? Well, no, yeah, I am. You know, and... You know, he could barely speak. He didn't. He went in for the interaction in the agency, wearing a torn baseball cap and a kind of bizarre scarf and hoodie combination. This is the other side of that sanction process.
Yeah, it may be. Maybe it's not. I mean, I don't know how much bearing that has on a private recruitment company. I think, you know, the best advice they could have given to young Danny would have been, try to, why don't you throw that baseball cap away? It had stains all over it. Perhaps that doesn't really matter for the manual work he was looking to do. And most importantly, try and turn up every day for at least a short while.
Well,
this is what his advisor said to him. He said they don't care if you're feeling poorly on your second afternoon. They just care that they've got somebody who can come and do the job. Yeah, I mean, again, people are ill prepared for what is expected of them. I don't know that taking away the slender financial support that they get from the state is the necessary motivating factor.
Well, it's not taken away, it's reduced.
Well, in some instances, it's completely taken away, isn't it?
Yeah, but you can still claim hardship payments. This is the other thing that nobody ever focuses on. They think, you're actually left without anything. But you can always, even if you've been sanctioned, you can go back in to another window and say, right, I've just been sanctioned, I need to claim hardship payments, which are, about 60% if you're a single person of the normal standard benefits, but you can claim those benefits.
Yeah, I mean, this is a whole other debate. I think so.
And well, let me just say this: I think it is a useful tool for Danny, yes, just to say no, but just to put it this way to him: look, you're saying, this is the way you live and whatever, and you've been, in inverted commas, a stay-at-home dad for 6 years, you know, you've got no grooming skills, you can't be bothered to turn up, and you're still smoking weed. If you do all those things, please feel free. This is a free country. Go ahead and do it. But we're going to stop or reduce your benefits if you do so. Now, you make the choice. If you want to make yourself presentable and stop smoking weed and actually, look, we'll give you some money. Here's a shirt and a tie and a jacket and some trousers. And you go and make yourself available and actively seek work, we'll give you the benefits to support that. But if you don't, then we're going to sanction your benefits. I have no problem with that at all.
I do, because I think the outcomes aren't the ones that anybody is seeking. And I think, as this program showed, is that when and he didn't need to, when his advisor got behind him and gave him a second and third chance, finally we saw him in a job that he seemed to be sustaining, and was glad to do so. excuse me. Mm. To be fair to Danny, he had put himself into the process of trying to find work, and he fell over his first placement, and he was lucky that there was another placement available to him, I have to say. But when we saw him at the end, he seemed to have found his feet, and good on him for that. And I think if all the encouragement he'd got was a reduction in his benefits or a hardship payment instead, then he would have just been all the more isolated and alienated and all the more reluctant to actually, you know, rejoin a productive way of life. So
yeah, but you see, you're taking something that I said in isolation. I'm not saying that's the only thing. He should receive full support.
But, yes, of course. But what I'm saying is the support that made the difference without necessitating sending the poor guy to a porridge diet. You know, it was the support that produced the outcome without the need for any financial intervention. The support shouldn't have had to have come from a nice guy at a private recruitment agency. It should have been inherent in the system, but it was.
So in your view, if Danny stayed at home smoking weed and living in his baseball cap and his hoodie and made absolutely no effort whatsoever, which is what appeared to have been going on for the previous 6 years, you would not sanction his benefits. You just carry on paying out of your taxes.
No, I would. What I would support an intervention in that instance where the support that almost echoes this situation in Medicine Hat is give the guy a job and the support to undertake it. Nobody wants to see people wasting their lives in an unproductive situation funded by the taxpayer. That's unfair on everybody. But
but you would have, just to really pressure on this, you would have no ultimate sanction. You would there are no circumstances in which you would say to Danny, you're not getting your full benefit.
No, because I don't believe that, I don't believe that produces the outcome that we're looking for, painful though that may be. The inclination to punish people for failing is not one that I think should be hardwired into the system.
Wow, okay. I suppose we could both agree it was all rather depressing, somewhat soul-destroying, and personally I'm glad I'm not 20 years old and looking for a job in Bradford. It looked a tough environment. I did feel sorry for, I meant to say, I felt sorry for the poor girl in a job interview who was asked, if she was a kitchen appliance, which would she be?
Yes, that was bizarre. And of course you immediately think, what if I'd been asked that? What would you say? Would you say, I refuse to answer that. It's a ridiculous question. Or would you have to come up with a kitchen appliance? I don't know.
I'd rather fear I would say the former. I'd say, really, if that's, let me teach you how to interview
people.
Well,
then you'd get your benefits
sanctioned,
for making yourself willfully unemployed, yes.
This was the Job Centre on Channel 4 on Wednesday at 10 p.m. It was the first episode of 3. It is available on demand. It was narrated by Robert Glenister and produced by Susie Ratner.
Absolutely no reason it should be a series. It would be a perfectly adequate half an hour documentary, if that. Anyway, that means it's time to place the Parish Council back in its fur-lined box on top of the wardrobe until next week. Right now we're off to Sweden with an Argos socket set to start work on that big new arena they're going to need for next year's Eurovision. Just time to thank the resplendent Terence Dackham.
I'll be seeing you.
And of course lots of thanks to you, because you're our favourite listener. There's more at therockingvicar.com. That's therockingvicar.com. In the meantime, I'm Magnus Shaw. Bye bye.
For you, never alone. You have been listening to a DACA Media production.